Welcome to the Divorce Podcast, where we explore all aspects of ending relationships, separation, and parenting apart. If your marriage or partnership has ended, or you have friends and family who are separating, this podcast is for you. I'm Kate Daly, a relationship counsellor, divorce specialist, and co-founder of Amicable, the online legal service for separating couples. In each episode, we look at relationships and separation from different angles, including the emotional, legal, and social. I'm joined by experts and special guests who share their own unique stories, experience, and tips with the goal of helping people end relationships in a kinder and better way. In this episode of the Divorce Podcast, I was joined by Jodie Karras, founder of the online therapy platform Selfspace, to discuss the emotional journey of separation and the role of forgiveness in the healing process. Jodie is a therapist with over 20 years' experience in the field and a Tavistock-trained executive coach. She's fast become one of the leading voices advocating for accessible mental health support. She's the co-author of How to Grow Through What You Go Through, published by Penguin in 2022, and regularly contributes to panel talks, podcasts, and media titles such as Stylist Magazine, Cosmopolitan, Vogue, and The Times. We begin this episode by discussing Jodie's background and how she got into the profession and ended up founding Selfspace, including her own individual experience of divorce. Throughout the episode, we discuss topics such as forgiveness and moving past and overcoming resentment, and replacing it with compassion, especially when it comes to co-parenting. If you loved this episode, then please subscribe and rate us on your preferred listening platform. Welcome, Jodie. This podcast really today is going to focus on forgiveness and compassion around separation and endings. But before we jump into that, I just wonder if you give us a little bit of your sort of personal story. So first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, and why you decided to found Selfspace.
Yeah, so I started my career actually as a television presenter. I was a wildlife presenter when there were only five channels. And I had spent my entire kind of youth and, you know, early 20s just thinking I wanted to be on the telly. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but that's kind of was my objective. And when I got there, I realized I was really unhappy. It wasn't, and you know, I'd be in these incredible places in the Bahamas doing dolphins. And I remember calling my mum one day and she said, "You don't sound great." And I said, "I'm so unhappy." And she said, "Oh, what are you going to do then?" And so I left TV almost immediately, actually. And I can remember everybody sort of saying, "But you've got such a great career." And from the outside, a bit like with divorce, actually, things can seem and appear one way, but actually on the inside of them, they're something else. And so I was a trained actress. So I trained as a drama therapist is my primary training. And then I went on to further study psychotherapy. And I founded Selfspace nearly 6 years ago based on, it was just a gut instinct, honestly. I was having more and more conversations with people about coming into companies to talk about mental health, but don't say mental health and don't talk about feelings. And I was thinking, okay, we've got a problem here. What's going on? And I also felt that my own experience of therapy had been very clinical. It spoke to ill health, not progression, not potential. And I felt like there was something that I could do in this space that was tasteful, attractive to other people, and something that the world probably could use. So I just took a punt and I found a space and I began. Honestly, that's how we started. We started with three therapists. We're almost 120 clinicians now. We've got five sites across London, and we are the first on-demand high street mental health service. So that's been really exciting. So that's kind of a bit of a nutshell, really. I've been a clinician for actually 24 years, and so a long time, massive period of my life. And we wrote a book last year for Penguin called How to Grow Through What You Go Through. And one of the chapters that I get the most messages, thank you. One of the chapters I get the most messages about is the one on divorce and separation. So I find that, you know, it's very, very topical, actually.
You just mentioned there this word of being an on-demand therapy service. So just explain to people what that means and how that's different to how therapy normally works. Because I think this is quite an interesting sort of part of your business, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, one of the things that I really thought that we could remove as a barrier to access was having therapists available if you wanted to talk to somebody now. not just online, but face-to-face. We're the only face-to-face provider in the UK who does hybrid, both face-to-face and virtual. So we've got no waiting lists. You can go online, you can choose who you want to work with, and you can normally have a session within an hour. We're open 7 days a week, 7:30 to 9:30 in the evening. So super flexible, a bit more like you might go and get your nails done. So bringing a kind of immediacy, removing some of the shame that I think really shrouds still talking about how we feel and how we're doing. And we've got beautiful sites on the high street, and there's no more kind of scuttling in the back door to your therapist, hoping no one sees you. Something just a bit more vibrant and a bit different. And we work with businesses as well as individuals and couples and kids. So we have a kind of hybrid across those two things. We support some incredible brands with mental health support for their employees.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because one of the biggest problems with therapy is the accessibility. And it feels like you're just really just charging down all of that kind of stuff. And just because when you've got a problem and you want to talk about it, it's the immediacy of it that causes the distress, isn't it? And then sometimes the thoughts that run away with you when you can't access or can't speak to somebody to, you know, work through the emotion. So I really love the idea of it being that kind of instantaneous access. And just making it, like you say, dead normal just to rock up and go and have a chat and see your therapist, just like you would get your manicure or whatever done. And I love that idea of making therapy accessible and just normal. It's just normalizing, isn't it? Why wouldn't you talk if somebody's got a problem? Why wouldn't you? Jodi, you just mentioned this word on demand. Just tell us a little bit about what that means in terms of therapy and how it's different to, you know, traditionally how therapy has been purchased and people have sort of interacted.
Yes. So, you know, one of the things that I think can be really challenging is one, finding a therapist, two, going to the GP, which is the first place we think about going, which is where people who are sick go. Then you have a huge amount of waiting lists, and it's very difficult to get access to somebody that you might click with. I also think that sometimes it's really helpful to just go and talk without it becoming a big deal. And I do think when we have to register with the doctor, who did the NHS do a great job, look, but and then having to wait, sometimes the thing that we were stuck with, we've moved through. So with us, you can book almost within an hour, face to face or virtual. We're open 7 days a week. Very easy to get an appointment. You can choose your clinician, which I think is so important, this empowering piece, which is, this is a person I'm going to be in a room with. I need to feel I can relate to them rather than someone else telling you, this is who I think you should see. All of that actually puts us in a disempowered position. And I'm really about an autonomy around our own wellness. What do I need? Is this conversation helpful for me? When do I want to go? All of those things are in the hands of the client. So just changing the shape of it a little bit. And I think commonly therapy is thought about as a place we go at crisis point. Yes, we do that, but we're also a prevention service. So in the same way, we don't wait until we are really, really overweight often to look after our wellness and our health and our fitness. Let's try to think about our mental health in that way. If we don't flex a muscle regularly, we won't have the tools to navigate really hard, choppy waters, which we'll all hit at some point, you know?
I love the idea. It's kind of democratizing it, isn't it? And it's sort of removing that power imbalance that you often get with therapy, which can really hamper how you bond with a therapist and that kind of stuff. Putting the power back into the individual's hands to say, this is the kind of person I need. This is when I need the therapy. And it's not necessarily going to be at 11 o'clock in the morning or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when the therapist feels like they want to work. It's going to be something that suits me after work, before work, whatever. As you say, that normalization of therapy and talking and being able to communicate about our feelings is a skill we all need, and it pays dividends across all of the different relationships we have in our life. So you're right. You might be going because there's a particular problem, but everything else in your life gets the benefit as well. And I love that idea of, like you say, treating it as a muscle.
Yeah, 100%.
Just getting good at it.
And keep flexing it, getting good at it. And, you know, like, you know, everything we do is relational, really, whether it's in relation to our creativity, to people. And therapy is a place to practice, play around with relational dynamics. You know, what a brilliant place to have a conversation which says, how do you find me? You know, how am I showing up? Because sometimes we have a false sense of how we're received. And, you know, I always think about therapy as a place to try stuff out, to have the difficult conversation first, to take a tentative step into really creating an intimate relationship. And I think in the UK, we don't think about it as progressively as we might actually. And I hope that we're taking some steps in the right direction, but we've still got quite a long way to go on that. But I think you put it really nicely in terms of that democracy around it. And
well, we'll put all the details of where people can find you and they can have a look at the website and they can, you know, experiment and book some therapy themselves. But for now, let's talk a little bit if we can. So you told us a bit about your background. Let's talk, this is the Divorce Podcast. Let's talk about your separation. So you separated from your ex. Tell us a little bit about that journey to separation and through.
Yeah, definitely. It would be strange to come on a divorce podcast and not share a bit of your own story about it, wouldn't it? Yeah, so my ex-husband Oscar and I, we were together for close to 22 years actually, so a long time. I was quite young when I met Oscar, so I was 19 and he's 10 years older than me. We separated 5 years ago now. We have a pretty good relationship actually. It's been really quite amicable. It wasn't at the start. It was incredibly difficult, but I think we've both worked really, really hard on fostering a good enough relationship, actually. And I can remember him saying to me very early on in our relationship, and he had anxieties around it in the beginning. He said, I think you're going to leave me. And I was like, no, I'm definitely not. But I think he did know, actually, somewhere deep down, even though it was a really difficult realization, I think, for me to come to first and for him. We've got two kids. Elvis is nearly 17. He's just doing his GCSEs. Bieber is 14. You know, when I look back on it, actually, we had a conversation on the phone the other day. We don't talk now in a very intimate way. And I realize, actually, we never actually did, honestly. I noticed that in reflection. But he did say to me, and this is the first time I've really heard him sort of take ownership over the decision to end. He said, I think we probably should have separated a long time before we did. And I do think in hindsight, we probably should have. I think, you know, what happened, I think we did have a good relationship. We were really good friends and he's got a brilliant sense of humor. And that was something that really connected us. But I don't think I was in a position internally that I could have ever thought about ending until I did. I don't think I had the confidence or courage to understand how to be on my own. And I think that prevented me from really thinking about the relationship and was it serving either of us? It was just a kind of fear-led thing, which was, this is what I'm doing and this is where I'm staying. And it absolutely wasn't terrible. It was amazing. But we did fight a lot. We were incredibly conflict-driven. We couldn't really talk about anything difficult, which sounds amazing for a therapist to say, but it really was that. And I think what happened was I just grew up a lot. I grew and changed. And I suddenly understood that I had the power and capacity within me to survive an ending. And I'm not very close to my family. I love them and we're connected, but I'm not close in the way that I could have fallen back onto them. And I think I needed Osk. I think I needed him. And it took me quite a long time to get to a place to understand that I might be able to think about this relationship being over. I also had no experience of endings. I'd had a couple of boyfriends before, but nothing major. Endings weren't talked about. It's still shame-filled. You know, what went wrong with your marriage? This normalization of relationships having a season is so important for young people to understand that it doesn't have to be forever. And that's okay. How do we end with grace? That wasn't something in my rhetoric. It wasn't something that I understood as being normal.
Well, I think with endings as well, it's always the temptation is to say the whole relationship was a failure from start to finish because it's ended. And this idea that you can have a good relationship that comes to a natural conclusion, and then there is a process that you can both go through that means you can end in a good way and have a good ending and then move on. It's quite a new sort of phenomenon, isn't it? It's not something Hollywood or script writers for EastEnders or anybody else has ever sort of really tackled and got hold of. There always has to be a crisis, a disaster, and we all have to wake up and see it's been terrible forever. And we should, if only we'd had the scales falling from our eyes earlier, we'd have been out of this. And it just, that's not most people's experience, is it? Most people's experience.
Well, it's nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. Most people feel they've had a good ride and it's come to an end and now they need to do something about it. And I think that's just, that's what we need to work on, isn't it? That idea, as you put it beautifully.
100%.
That it has a season.
How do we? It has a season. And also, yes, let's hold on where we can, but also let's practice letting go lightly and let's understand that it isn't the end of everything. As you say, everything that's been doesn't cease to have been. And there is a future. Actually, I'm just working with a couple now who've got back together after 20 years. And I'm not proposing that's everyone. But what I do think is we should understand that relationships are just that. They're two people who are connected and in relationship with each other and themselves. And, you know, whatever that means and whatever the journey is, that's okay. It's a biblical connotation that we should be together forever. And this idea of religion and convention and societal norms and all of that stuff that keeps us locked in to what might not be right. And I do want to stress, actually, I was talking about this on another podcast. Just because the decision is right, it doesn't mean that you aren't going to grieve it. And I think I wasn't. Had I not been in therapy for so long and worked with so many people, you know, I had such profound feelings of grief about the loss of my family unit, of a relationship that was a friend that I'd had for 22 years. And I had moments of oscillating between, God, if I feel this wretched, then maybe it's the wrong decision. And I think we need to normalize that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? You can feel really bad about something and it can still be the right decision. And as you say, you can be in the depths of despair and loss and still think that you need to push through and to move on. It doesn't, they're not indicators that you've made a wrong decision. But that's, in some ways, this is what you're talking about, isn't it? The job of the therapist is to help you, we always say work through, but it's like interpret those feelings, isn't it? And interpret those emotions and to make sense of them. So you can keep moving through the journey. And I think one of the things that really struck me when you were talking there is there's a big part of you that you talk about the relationship being your friend. And one of the sort of necessary jobs when you separate from someone is to separate yourself and the relationship and to remember they are two very separate things. Because sometimes, particularly in long-term relationships, especially when you've got kids and you've been completely sort of, you know, running a unit, you and the relationship become one and the same thing. And we have to go through that process of rediscovering who we are rather than who we show up as in the relationship. And I think that's a really key piece of the work, isn't it? When you end a relationship, is that rediscovering your sense of self.
Yeah, and your relationship to yourself. I think, you know, it's such a critical relationship. And I think when you've been in a long-term relationship, however healthy it is, you do suddenly rely so much on the external dynamic. And that's not a judgment around whether that's right or wrong. But we have to know that we might lose contact with some aspects of ourselves, which I think is often what happens. And I think it happens for women sometimes post having children. You know, when you've gone through that survival mode piece, which is, God, we've got to stay together because otherwise we can't get through, you know. And then you come out the other side of that and you look at your partner and you think, I don't know you anymore. And I don't know myself and I don't know myself with you. And I think that happens often in relationships at that stage, actually. And some people find their way back to each other and the relationship is stronger and they reinvent the dynamic and they move forward. And others, you're so changed or altered or different, both of you, that finding that way back isn't possible. The only way is forward.
That's when therapy can be really useful, can't it? Like you say, when you hit a new life stage and you've effectively got to re-navigate the rules, because maybe, as you say, it's post-children, so you don't have the sort of the chaos and the just sheer amount of stuff that you have to be doing for everybody to sort of be the glue in the relationship. And I always think that therapy at those times, before it reaches a crisis or a disaster, just as an opportunity to re-examine the relationship and who you both are, is such an opportunity. And sometimes, like you say, it does end in you deciding to go your separate ways. But again, that's when we can see life moving on as an opportunity rather than some of the negative feelings that we tend to associate. You mentioned before the guilt, the shame that still surrounds the ending of a relationship. And I feel that we have to get better at trying to help people. It's not that they're not going to feel those things, but realize that that's a short passage of time and there are bigger emotions and bigger opportunities that come and that are better to explore than just sitting in those sort of quite stereotypical ones we often get sort of pushed into from a
and also stuck.
Yeah.
I think stuckness is such a depleting phase, you know, and we work with people that can be stuck for years, not just in relationships, but jobs, you know, family dynamics, you know. Do something, step somewhere, you know, and I think stuckness is paralyzing across your life. And you might only notice it in one area, but actually once you start moving something, changing something, I'm going to go to a gym class, other things start to evolve and you realize, okay, I can cope with change. I understand that I can navigate these things, and those small communications to yourself show you that you can. And then when you come face to face with the bigger things, you know, they're less terrifying. Just on the therapy thing, you know, we work with couples and we work with individuals, and we, you know, what I think therapy is really good for and what I think can happen a lot in relationships is we spend our time looking at the other person. What are they doing? How are they making me feel? Let me try and change them. I'm going to tell them about how they make me feel. And actually, the power we have is in our accountability to ourselves. What am I doing here? How am I responsible for the environment I am creating? And that can be a disgusting place to be, because no one wants to know how awful they're being, you know, or how difficult they are to live with, or how annoying they are. But that is such a humbling place to be. And from that place, we can get to, I'm so sorry. And I think sorry and being sorry and holding the shame, which is attached to a genuine sorry, is such a powerful transformative tool within any type of relationship, actually, whether it's ending or it's not. And real sorry comes from self-reflection.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because that kind of leads me on to this idea of forgiveness as well, and the role of forgiveness in ending a relationship successfully. So how do you talk about forgiveness? And do we start with forgiving ourselves, or do we need to forgive others before we forgive ourselves? Is it the whole oxygen mask thing, or is forgiveness working in a different way?
Interesting. I think, firstly, I do just want to caveat, if you are in an abusive relationship and you are talking it through, you don't have to forgive. We don't have to forgive everything. Like, I want to start there. We can accept, we don't have to forgive. I think putting ourselves under pressure to do something or make an internal change will probably never work. What I do think is that tough things in our lives can send us both ways. They can either harden us, you know, like this kind of very stoic, I think very fragile, brittle, outer edge, which is I'm tough.
Yes, brittle is the word, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. And nothing good comes from brittle, actually, because we just break. You know, I remember someone saying to me once, bamboo is such a great metaphor because it's the strongest wood in the world, actually, but it's so flexible. And that flexibility is the thing that's going to serve you. How can you move through the ending of a relationship without hardening? How do I stay soft? And you have to know that by staying soft, that means you are going to feel the extremities of all your emotions, and that can be really shitty. But once you get to that place, which is, I feel this loneliness, I feel these profound, you know, out of control, whatever your feelings are, in that you can remain softer. How can I meet myself with compassion? And in meeting myself with compassion, I can then meet my ex-partner, my children, in a space of softness. I don't mean some people, we confuse being soft with being a walkover or pushover. I don't understand it like that. I understand it as being an inner state that allows you to just navigate like water, like flowing, as opposed to that rigid thing.
That point you made about the softness, I think it, for me, it's about remaining accessible, isn't it? So the softness for me is about not closing yourself off, because when you become destroyed by what's happened and you become brittle and you become very, I've got to protect myself, you're closing yourself off to so much stuff, not just from the person you're hurt by, but by the other people around you. And particularly if you've got kids and you're trying to co-parent at the same time as going through this kind of breakdown of a relationship or the ending of a relationship, it can put you in a very inaccessible place. And that can be really hard for your kids and for your friends and the other people around you, work colleagues and so on. So I kind of try and see it as you've got to try and stay in a place where you can still receive and be received, and you can still allow people in. Otherwise, you're living such a half life, aren't you? And it's hard and it's lonely.
You know, I think that disconnect, when we're not able to own the really, really difficult things, what we will experience is loneliness. And actually, that's the opposite of what we need when we go through these phases. And I was just going to say, my son, he doesn't say very much, but he has a brilliant way of staying very, very soft. And in the eye of the storm of everything, which was really quite fraught, it wasn't easy or gentle in the middle of deciding. I went up to say goodnight to him, and he was about 9, and I said, I couldn't find the words. I didn't know what to say. And he said, "You've broken my heart, Mummy." And there was something really powerful about him being able to say that, because it meant I could say sorry. And that's what you're talking about, which is staying accessible. He could say that because he knew I could hear it.
Yeah, it was safe for him to say it. He could rely on your reaction back. And from your perspective, you could not lose your bottle and say, "All right, I've broken your heart, so therefore I must unpick this in some weird way."
I'm not going.
Yeah, all right, then I'll stay. Yeah.
Pull yourself together. But just being able to meet that, yeah, I get it, my heart too. And I think there is something about, and I don't say that is easy, and it at times you will need to harden to survive, but ultimately graciousness, gratitude, can you reflect on what has been good about where you've been? And that will really help you to move forward with some grace. And I also spoke to in the middle of it, outside of my own therapy and coaching, I spoke to a colleague who I sometimes call, she's a child psychotherapist. And she said, one of the most powerful things you can do, particularly if you're leading the separation, is find a way to say sorry to your partner in front of your children or in front of other people that are finding it difficult, because witnessing that is a really transformative moment, because they see that what you had mattered and that the other person mattered and that you're able to take responsibility for what you're doing.
That's lovely. Yeah, that's really lovely. A really lovely idea.
I think it's quite powerful.
Yeah, it certainly is. That whole notion of being capable enough to take that on, that role on, and to say sorry, that's incredibly powerful, isn't it, for others to see and to bear witness to. And real.
Yeah, and real. And some people spend their whole lives in therapy talking about the fact they wish their parent had said sorry to them, or they wish their partner had taken ownership of their role in this thing. And I think if we can find that space, if we can really find that space, that's going to put you in really good stead for the kind of a future and moving forward without this becoming a kind of a chain around your shoulders, which it doesn't need to be.
But also from a co-parenting perspective as well, what a way to embed that sort of co-parenting ethos and to signal to your children what together, not together, which is effectively what co-parenting becomes, what that looks like and what it means. You know, being able to take responsibility for the fact that you're not together, but giving the other person and yourself the opportunity to still be the best parents you can be. It's just beautiful. Really feel really kind of emotional when you say that it's lovely.
It's a simple thing. And sometimes we can forget these really important human, you know, communications when we're navigating incredibly choppy waters. And, you know, that's the other thing that therapy does. It gives you a space to reflect. It, because it's not really ever the rupture. It's how we approach the repair. You know, we can always go back and we can always say, do you know what? I was thinking about you. I was thinking about that thing that I said, and I just want to put that right. You know, that is what I think can happen sometimes, is we do things and we go, oh, that, I don't feel, you know, whether we're able to think, I don't feel, well, that was not nice. And then we leave it, we park it. Actually, how can we keep returning to it and repairing? It can be weeks later. And in any context of your life, you know, even conversations with your boss, you know, can I just talk about what happened on Tuesday? Because actually, I should have, or I wish I'd, or whatever it is. It just loosens things up a bit. I think it allows you a bit of internal freedom, which is really hopeful.
I wonder what stops people from doing some of that stuff, though, because it's, you know, we're talking about it on the podcast in sort of the abstract, and it feels, of course, it feels, well, to me, it does anyway, intuitively the right thing to do. But why don't we do it then? What stops us? What are we frightened that is going to happen? Are we frightened about how we're going to feel or about losing our power in some way? What is it that stops us from being that kind of, I guess, in therapeutic terms, that self-actualized person who is in control and command of their, you know, their selves and how they manifest to the world sort of external to them? How do we do it? What stops us?
I think it's often a fear, defensive coping mechanisms, which we might have adopted over the years. And you might see that in kind of destabilizing behavior, over drinking, overeating, not taking care of yourself, creating drama in your own life, which prevents you from actually being in contact with your feelings. Because to show up in that actualized space, we've got to be able to connect with the difficult and the good feelings. And I think we're so well-versed, aren't we, right now? Oh, I don't feel good. Netflix. Oh, let me get Deliveroo. Let me just get on a dating app. All of this stuff is defensive in some way. It's a defense against yourself. And it can be really horrible. Like, I tried to go on, I started this thing of going away on holiday on my own. I did 10 days this year. Because I was terrified of doing that. I was like, oh, I can't. The idea of being with myself for 10 days. By day three, I was like, I love this. I'm not saying it was easy. There was a lot of journaling, a lot of inner child work, a lot of like, oh, I'm so lonely. But actually, there's something really, and even in moments and pockets of time, just trying to connect with yourself, you know, in an undefensive way. I think it's fair. I also think it's family patterns, you know, what intergenerational trauma, what terrible ways of communicating have we adopted from our families and parents? And how can we actively, consciously try to make a change there, which is, we might love our parents dearly, but we can also notice that's not very good how they deal with that, and what can I do differently here? So making conscious changes is really important, I think, for it. But it is fear. It's fear, isn't it? It's because we don't want to show up, you know, putting feelings into words, expressing ourselves, you know, even if we get there with a snotty nose and stuttering and let's do it. Let, you know, encourage yourself to step forward into the thing that feels difficult. Yes, liberating.
How do you work with people? So, you know, you often get a scenario, don't you, where there's a lot of resentment. So somebody has externally at least behaved badly. Maybe there's been an affair or something like that. And the other person is left with this deep sense of resentment. They might not be able to get answers from their partner because they've moved on. They've got a new boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, or a new partner. And you're left with this kind of simmering resentment where you're replaying conversations over in your head with the things you wish you'd said and all that kind of stuff. How do you get past the resentment? What are the psychological mechanisms that allow you to let go of those kinds of emotions and things?
God, it's so hard. That it's a horrible, horrible phase, isn't it? Where we're ruminating, and you know, I can be a ruminator. And I think we need to know there's no quick fix to healing, and there isn't a kind of one shoe fits all. I think rather than outward focus on the other person, thinking about how you showed up in the relationship is really important. You know, if they've hurt you, allow yourself to be hurt, allow yourself to be in pain, meet that with some compassion, treat yourself well, don't reflect, you know, don't give yourself another dose of what they've given you. So if they've treated you in a way that is hurtful and painful, then don't do nasty things to yourself. You know, treat yourself as if you are your best friend. Drink water, eat the nice food, move your body, do things that show you an opposite experience, even if it's really hard, even if you've got to drag yourself to the, you know, to your yoga class or to meet your friend for a coffee. The small steps, really important. If you find yourself ruminating on conversations, write them down, journal. You know, I'm not a big fan of gratitude journaling. I think it puts us in a place of having to be grateful. Be ungrateful if you want to. Write whatever you want down, but get it out. Find a way of kind of writing it out. Write a letter to your ex-partner. Don't send it. Read it out loud to a friend or in therapy. All the ways that you can try to give yourself a break from the ruminating thoughts. Also, don't glorify the relationship, because we can tend to rose tint what has been, which then just puts us into a desolate state. Oh, I never meet anyone like that. They were so perfect. No, they weren't. No one is ever perfect. So really think about the relationship and the reality of it, and allow yourself the opportunity to know that was one story from your life. There's going to be others, and they won't be the same, but there will be others. I think giving yourself a ruminating window. So going, I'm going to allow 15 minutes to indulge all my thoughts about my ex. And now I'm going to not try and do it anymore. I don't think sharing social media is helpful at all. You can be so interested in stalking them, and that's just going to cause you pain. I think even when I'm dating, I don't share my social media, because I don't think you want to be using your network in that way. So just some little things that speak to your self-worth, really. And it's horrible. Like, it's okay to feel rubbish. It's not nice. You know, human emotions are really difficult, and that's it's okay. It's normal. I think normalizing that is really important as well.
Do you think there's a point at which, you know, I agree, at the normalizing these feelings, and we're living in a world, aren't we, at the moment, where everything's got a label and everything's sort of not normal, and it has to be treated.
Everyone's
and
a
sorted.
Narcissist.
Yeah, everyone's a narcissist. Do not believe that.
Everyone is.
Or, you know, whatever it is. It kind of feels a bit relentless sometimes. But is there a point at which it's not normal, and you do need to go and get some extra help? And what's the boundary between, this is just normal, everybody goes through it, we don't need to over-pathologize it, we don't need to over-therapize it, but is there a point when that starts to tip into something else? And what are the signs that you might be needing some extra support?
Yeah, I mean, I think navigating a breakup anyways, it's really good to be in therapy. Like, it doesn't have to be at the crisis crunch point. I think if your thoughts about your ex are stopping you, or your thought, you know, your experience of the breakup is stopping you engage in normal life, in everyday life, that's not great. If it's having an impact on your work life, your other relationships, all of that stuff, that feels. But get someone alongside you. Like, a therapist is someone that's going to give you a kick up the backside and also be your biggest champion. So have someone in your camp. Why not? You know, why not have that?
Yeah, I think if your relationship is ending, it should be almost the first thing you think about, isn't it? Like, where do I get my therapy? Where do I get my support? Because I guess that kind of brings us on to the friends and family angle. Friends and family and support networks, and we all talk about it, don't we? So it's really good and important to have a network of friends and family. But there's only so much support and help they can be. And in terms of advice, sometimes, although they obviously the intention is there and the meaning well part is there, but sometimes in an effort to support you, they can really polarize the situation unintentionally, and you end up then being in a sort of a worse position, because ultimately, particularly from sort of the amicable perspective, there are certain things you've got to sort out whilst you're going through this emotional upheaval, like how you're going to look after children if you've got children, where you're all going to live, those sorts of things. They're decisions that sometimes can't wait as long as your personal internal process. So there are decisions you're going to have to make when you're not feeling at your best or in the right space to make big decisions, but it's inevitable. That's life. That's how stuff often kind of happens. So friends and family, good to a point, but therapy much better at actually having a safe space to get a bit of perspective maybe.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's loads of tricky stuff. You're right. You find yourself in this space of having to make really big, massive decisions at a time when you're at sea anyway. I found loads of comfort in being close to other friends, just a few who had also or were going through something similar, you know, the kind of your divorce chums and, oh God, this is awful. And oh, I'm not sure how to manage this. And, you know, that's helpful. Family and friends have also, you know, impact of separation and people splitting has huge impact on other people in your life because it brings up stuff for them, their own experience of childhood, their own experience of separation and divorce. It makes them look at their own. I mean, I lost quite a few friends going through this journey, and not because they sided, but because I think it terrified them that I was suddenly becoming different or I didn't seem the same or they couldn't understand me in the way that they had. And
I think people are frightened it's contagious, aren't they, as well? They're frightened they're going to catch it.
It's so true. Yeah. All the exactly. And they become so terrified. Is it going to empower my partner to leave me? Oh, you know, all those really primal anxieties and fears come up for people. So, and friends and family will know or have known your partner, your ex-partner. So they're never going to be impartial. You know, bitching about your ex. Okay, look, it's immediate relief, but long term, it's not that productive. Not really. You know, to say I'm really hurting and I feel horrible about what's happened, sure. But they are this and they are that, which you can get drawn into a lot with friends and family and parents, whatever, because they think that's what you want to hear. It's not that helpful. It's not that progressive for you.
No, and we all move on at different paces. So you might ultimately come to a place of forgiveness of yourself and your ex, and you may be having a sort of a much better co-parenting relationship. But your friends and family that you've spent ages slagging your ex off to, they haven't been on the same journey. So they're still on that script when you're trying to co-parent. It's really deeply unhelpful. You need them to stay neutral, particularly when there are children involved and you're going to have that ongoing relationship, I always think.
Definitely. Yeah. Very complex. Enormously complex. It's a hard life phase. I think it's all right to mess it up. It's all right to get it wrong. We don't know what we're doing all of the time. It's hard. It's feelings. It's emotions. It's other people. It's, you know, this is why there's so many songs about it, so many films about it, so many poems and writing.
I think we should be starting a campaign for mandatory therapy when your relationship ends. That's kind of, I think this is where we should go with this. But is there any point if you've got a reticent partner? So if you want to do a good ending and you see therapy as a way of helping you end better and your partner just doesn't want to do it, is there any point going down that road and trying to keep persuading and giving the opportunity? Or are there things you can do just as an individual that will make a difference, even if your partner won't engage in some kind of therapy to help you end well?
I think only one of you needs to change. It's amazing if both of you can do the work, but one of you doing the work is better. You know, don't take the position, well, they're not going to, so I'm not. No one's going to win from that. You concentrate on you. You can show up in difficult situations different. They might not at first, but somewhere it will have an impact. So focus on what you can control, which is how you step into this. Just because they don't want to, you know, what can happen is people go, well, it's not my fault. It's not my job to do this. Well, you're not doing it for them. You're doing it for you. And probably what shows up in the conversation about therapy is not dissimilar to what's gone in the relationship. So if they're a forward thinking, you know, personal growth mindset person, they'll be right there with you. If they're not, which is often why relationships end at the core, then don't expect it just because you're ending.
I'm really conscious of time. It's been absolutely fabulous talking to you, Jodie. Just sum up, if you would, just a couple of tips for people. If someone's listening to this and they're going through the ending of a relationship, what are the one or two things that you would recommend to ease this transition for them at this point in time?
You know, firstly, no, it's really hard. And I'm really sorry if you're struggling. I think, you know, that's the first thing to say. The second is think today about three small changes that you can make to support yourself. That might be drinking more water. It might be sharing what's happening with a close friend. It might be not drinking so much this evening. What can you do? Those three small things. The other is to ask yourself this. Every single morning, put your hand on your chest and ask yourself, how am I feeling, my love? And then allow all of the feelings to emerge in your head, the complex, difficult ones. And then you're going to ask yourself, and what do I need, my love? And then you allow yourself to come with the answers of what you need. And it might be, I need a hug. I need to sit down. I need to say this thing. Just allow yourself those moments in the morning to connect with yourself. Those are just a few. In our book, there are loads, actually. There's a whole section on how to look after yourself through separation and divorce. So
just mention the name of the book, Jodie.
It's called How to Grow Through What You Go Through. And it's a generalized mental health kind of everyday book, but there is a section which I wrote on separation and divorce.
That's fabulous. Where can people find out about you? So we've heard about the book. Just tell us a little bit about the website and where people can find you if they want help.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Kate. Such a lovely conversation. So important. You can find us at theselfspace.com, on Instagram at theselfspace. We've got loads of workshops, talks. You can join our community. And of course, we offer therapy. So join the community, because we're all messy, complicated feeling beings, and being together in some way, whatever it is really helpful.
Thank you. That's wonderful. And of course, you can hear about the new podcast episodes by subscribing for updates and visiting thedivorcepodcast.com or on your favorite listening platform. If you've been triggered by this episode for separation and co-parenting support, you can visit amicable.co.uk, where you can explore our resources, or you can book a free 15-minute consultation. Thanks so much for your time, Jodie, and thank you, everybody, for listening.